Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to one of the most influential comics artists and one of the most diverse comics artists it's ever been my pleasure to know. His career spans from the late 1940s to today, and all of us who are aware of his work are huge fans. There's something very unique about his style, and something very human about his style. And ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to give a round of applause for Mr. Russ Heath. That's it. We're gone. No. So you were born in Jersey? A Jersey kid?
Well, actually born in New York, but carried away to New Jersey immediately.
Yeah. When did you first get the cartooning bug or the illustration bug?
Well, I was an only child, for one thing, and I didn't have anything to do. Yeah. And my father, they had cheap tablets in those days. I forget what they were called, but everybody had the same tablets. Yeah. And so I just started drawing on them. And then my father said, you got to start turning the paper over and using both sides. And because it was still the Depression on.
Yeah.
And I just kept drawing. I didn't realize that for at least 5 years that I was any different than, you know, I just wondered why everybody couldn't do it.
Yeah. And
it seemed logical to me that they could. And
whose work were you looking at that age?
Oh, well, in very early, there was Captain Easy and Roy Crane, I guess, did that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, you can see a lot of Roy Crane in your early
and
work.
The first of... Dickie Deere was like a Terry and the Pirates thing in reverse color.
Right.
He was dark-haired, and the grown-up was blonde, and as opposed to Terry and the Pirates.
So completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. And then... outside comics? I mean, were you looking at, you know, Lydecker or Loomis or any of, you know?
Well, my father, in those days, they used to have on Saturdays for the kids, they'd have these serials that continued week to week, and you come back to see, you know, continued next Saturday. Okay. So my father took me especially the cowboy ones, because he had been a cowboy, and that was a big deal. It wasn't any television in those days. You had to make your own play.
Rewind. Your dad was a cowboy. That's pretty cool. What part of the country was he living in? Don't tell me New York.
No, he grew up in Ontario, Hamilton, Ontario.
Yeah.
And he, at the end of World War One, he went to Arizona,
yeah,
and became a cowboy. Yeah. And then he worked in the copper mines, and then he worked in the power plants. Hooked up with Westinghouse, came across the country to Pittsburgh and met my mother, and came on to Jersey and started with me. And,
yeah. So I'm sorry to interrupt. I thought that was really interesting. So then you were watching the serials with Tom Mix and the Cowboys as well, I guess. So,
and one of the things that I learned early was that, like, they'd have a cowboy come on. He's got this flowery shirt, you know, all this fancy gawk stuff on. And my father said, "That's no cowboy. Anybody, any cowboy ever looked at that knows that guy had never been near the woods." So I realized that if you want people to believe you know what you're talking about,
yeah,
same thing with war stuff.
Sure. You
know, look at that and say, that guy's never been near a rifle or something. Yeah. You know. So if you want to make people believe what they're looking at,
yeah,
get it right.
Well, that's always been a hallmark of your work, though, is your very, very careful attention to detail on that sort of thing.
But I still wanted... When I drew a tank or something, I tried to draw it in a way that the kid was going to pick it up and run across the carpet.
So how old were you when you got your first professional work? I mean,
oh, 16 or so.
Wow, 60. You were a kid, and that was for That was for Holyoke. Was that for?
Okay. Holyoke.
And you were? Do you remember what you were working on back then for Holyoke? Or
I was working on high school.
So school, seriously, school during the day and then drawing at night.
Well, in the summertime, when I went to summer camp for a number of years, and then my marks were so bad that I went to summer school, and that wasn't a kick. And so my father said, he heard of it in his commuting to New York every day on the train. Mm-hmm. He met a lot of people, and one of them knew of a comic outfit that might be able to use me to draw. So he made an appointment for me, and I went up, and they gave me a script and told me I was not to use a pen anymore. I thought it was all done with pen and ink, and it was done with brush and ink. So I guess I started right out with Winsor Newton number 7 or something.
How much of a learning curve was that for you?
I don't understand the question.
Well, I mean, had you worked with brushes before extensively? Had you worked in brush before extensively?
No.
So it had to have taken you a little time to get the knack, right?
Yeah, well, a day or two and you start to get a little proficient in it.
Right. Day or two. People out here who study for years and still don't have it. You really were a natural, I think.
I do too, because when people ask me, they say, I just didn't understand why everybody couldn't do it.
Now, was that a bullpen situation, or were you working freelance?
Oh, I was working at home and bringing this stuff in.
So, okay. And then finishing high school at the same time.
Well, trying to finish
high school. All right.
Let's see if we can get it done before he's drafted. And So I joined I was going to go to Canada because in the RCAF you could be 17 instead of 18 as in our country.
Right.
So my father said, it makes more sense to try to finish your high school and then join your own air, a year later, join the Air Force. So I tried. They normally didn't let such a bad student try the accelerated course because it was 3 or 5 times more work. But they knew that my intelligence tests were enough. You know, it's just that I was more interested in drawing or chasing girls. I was chasing girls so long ago that some of them used to even stop.
And why the Air Force? Was it? Did you have some?
Well, it sounded better than mud.
All right. Yeah.
And fighter pilot? Are you kidding?
Not true.
So I was gonna, And so I joined in the reserve Army Air Force, hoping to graduate before I was called.
Okay.
It didn't work that way, so I went in.
This is like 44, 45. When?
45.
45, okay.
The early part of 45. And then Hitler heard that I had joined and quit.
Throwing in the towel.
So then they decided they didn't need so many second Louis just for the Far East, or whatever you call it. Yeah. And so they started weeding out all the cadets, the ones, and they have these tests that would try to wipe them out and get, just keep the cream.
Right.
And I guess I did pretty well on those tests because I was slow and particular about it. And I think they need that. When they're going to give you an airplane, they don't want you to forget to put the landing gear down or something, you know.
Yeah, again,
so like the attention to
attention
detail.
Attention to detail, again. Saves your life.
Of course, I would have flunked out on the navigation, but because arithmetic was, no, not it.
Was there anybody else in your family who had an artistic bent? Anybody who, aunts, uncles, anybody who had an artistic gene?
Not that I knew of.
Interesting.
Somebody did a picture, but we never were able to figure out who.
Yeah.
And that was pretty well drawn, but I think I still have it. And I didn't have any brothers and sisters, so I don't.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I pulled something loose when I came out.
Well, so what did you do once you got out of the Air Force?
I went back to high school.
All right.
They had what they call the 52-20 Club. Mm-hmm. In 52 weeks, you got 20 bucks to reorient you to society. Mm-hmm. And so we went to the bar and got rid of the money. and that was that. And then I went on, I became a lifeguard, and I messed around with spearfishing, and it became, I joined a scuba club. And it was badly run, and so I was complaining and bitching about it, you know. And they said, if you don't like the way it's being run, why don't you, you know, elections are coming up, why don't you run for it? And, of course, the girl vote swept me into power. And, so I had my first, because I'm not a joiner, basically, and but I thought I did a good job.
I would say that I would, not to deflate, but I would think that there's only really two ways to run a scuba club. Either everybody lives, or not so much.
Well, as they said to me years later, ran into a few that have been in the class, and they said, boy, when you ran it, it was great. The one was too strict and too military, you know, everything exact.
Yeah.
And that's not fun, and it should be fun. And on the other hand, if you get screwy and be too loose with it, yeah, it all falls apart.
Yeah.
And so I learned a few things right there. Most of the time is you can't delegate too far. You got to do a lot of it yourself. And so while I was in it, it was fun. Once I went to the Caribbean, I didn't go anymore up in the area there, New Jersey or anywhere, because like one of my buddies came, says, we went over the weekend, we were scuba diving, and I said, what was the visibility like? And
yeah,
he said, oh, it was a foot and a half. I said, I can walk in the closet and get that. It doesn't do it. So as they say, once I went to the Caribbean where you could see to the back of the room underwater, it spoiled me for anything around Jersey.
Yeah. So what were you doing to finance your travels and your clubbing?
Oh, well, I became a lifeguard at this one swim club, as they called them in those days. And I also designed the men's room building. They built a new one. And I designed, I had a little girl diving in a life preserver, which was used on their T-shirts for sales. And I struck it. I learned that most people that are not in the business don't know how much our work is worth.
Right.
So I figured he's going to try to pay me, you know, $30 for all that work.
Yeah.
And I knew, you know, if I messed with it, I wouldn't get that.
Yeah.
So I said, how about, and I had my kids and stuff, and I said, how about a free membership? And that's all he has to do is, let's walk in.
Yeah.
Doesn't cost him anything. He was pleased as hell.
Yeah.
And I had a $500 membership.
There you go.
So
you've always been a smart businessman with that kind of stuff. With now, you got back into illustration through advertising, right? You worked through Benton and Bowles. Is that where you worked next?
I worked, well, I don't know which came next. That's a long time ago. But I know that I was, you know, I got married and I started having kids, and I thought I better get work. And in those days, nowadays, when somebody goes out to work, looking for work, you see them in the street a week later and say, how's the search for work going on? He said, I had an appointment last week. It didn't work out. And I thought, when I went looking for work, I looked from 10 o'clock in the morning until lunchtime, and then again until 4 o'clock. Now, after 4, they're already trying to go home, and before 9, they're still having their morning coffee. But it was a constant thing. Yeah. You looked like it was your daily job.
Yeah.
And, of course, you get a list, and the list, you tend to cross a lot of it out. But then some people say, come back in a couple of weeks, there may be something.
Yeah.
So your list always grows.
Yeah.
And finally, I got working for sharpening pencils for art directors for one of the better agencies at the time. And I think, I can't remember which one was which, but I know I worked for a bunch of them. And then I went over to, but the trouble was I was making, it was $35 a week, which $10 went for laundry and transportation.
Yeah.
So, commutation. And so I started looking for work during lunches. And of course, that's not terribly profitable because a lot of people go to lunch.
Yeah.
And, but eventually I walked in, and there was Stan Lee, and Stan Lee says, oh, I'll give you $75 a week. I thought, I just trebled my salary.
Yeah. You
know, and I was off and running.
Yeah, and that was a bullpen situation, wasn't it? That was you working out?
No, well, I started in the bullpen.
Okay. Like, do you remember?
And then he says, you don't have to come in here all the way from Jersey every day.
Yeah.
He said, just come in once a week and when it's finished. And,
Do you remember when you first started out there? Do you remember any of the other people you were working beside or anybody else in the office?
Yeah, there were quite a few of them, but it would take 10 minutes for me to remember 6 of them.
All right, well then.
But they were there.
All right. So at that point, and my memory is you were working mostly, I mean, you did a wide range of stuff for Stan, but
well,
mostly
of course,
weapons.
The cowboy thing still ran high because my father had been a cowboy.
Right.
And so the Western stuff. The ones I didn't like were Batman, because all the buildings and the windows have to be ruled, you know, and in rubble can't be wrong, right?
Right.
You can draw a war, you know.
Yeah.
And the Westerns, that was, and of course they're always looking for action.
Right.
And so you got guns in a Western. You also, everything was hewed out. It wasn't come out of a woodworking place.
Right.
You know. Everything was rough, so again, your line didn't have to be absolutely straight.
Yeah.
And underwater, of course, everything faded away, so you didn't have to be careful about that.
Yeah.
And again, the action, and try for a little nudity, maybe, but never get away with it.
You try to sneak some in every once in a while, did you?
Hmm?
Try to sneak some in every once in a while, did you?
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't give up.
So, and then early 50s, you also started working a little bit at EC Comics with Harvey Kurtzman.
Well, I worked in various, the comic business had its ups and downs. Like every 4 years, half the people would be fired because it was a bad year. And they'd all get work again, you know, but in each other's places. But it was a regular kind of a thing, and so you did your rounds, and you probably ended up working one of the other places. So that was.
Did you actually work closely with Harvey, or was it?
Oh, when I met Harvey, I started when I was at Stan Lee in the Empire State Building. Harvey Kurtzman was doing Hey Look, single page for comic book. Each month, and so we met in the met there and went to lunch, and so later we went to lunch for a second time, and he gave me a piece of work to do, little thing.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of that.
Yeah. And it's a, did it evolve into a genuine friendship, or was it really just more?
Well, I was more into having lunch, and I didn't seem to put it together that I end up with some work. All right, I have a lot of lunches, and, because I was probably, there was an inner circle, you know, like 8 guys that were his favorites, and I was the first one on the outside of the circle. But had I known that the company was sending everybody to Hawaii or Germany or every vacation time, why I'd have moved in, tried to move into the circle.
So you're right. Comics was very much a, you know, ups and downs business, and genres would come and go quickly. Romance comics would be hot for a little while and then not, and horror comics would be hot for a while and then not. But so, and you dabbled in all that stuff, but really where I think you made your real mark and got your footing as the Russ Heath we know today is at National Comics when you were working on the Warp material, when you first went over there. I mean, that's when you really became inextricably linked with the war genre.
Well, Kattiger only, at the time, seemed to only did war stories.
Yeah.
And so I just
now
started working there. But I realized, too, that if you only work for one outfit, they tend, human nature is such, they'll get you under their heel and grind, and they'll grind you in. So the thing is, you keep a second, always have at least two clients. So that they're worried that you may go permanently, they may lose you. So
well, tell me a little bit about working for Bob Kattiger, because I met him a couple of times myself. An incredibly talented man, an incredibly...
I don't know about that.
But I'm being politic, but he's... But
no, I, you know,
a
I mean,
colorful, a hmm? Very colorful man.
Colorful?
Colorful?
Okay, I'll buy that.
What? Tell us about...
Well, he used to like to exploit you until he found your weak point.
Yeah.
And then he found a way at that, just to upset you. And that was his joy, upsetting everybody.
Where did that come from? Is it just because he was...
It
like
was what he did.
Two? I know, but I mean, is it because he's like 4'2", or why? I mean, why would... What do you think possessed this man to be such a cranky...
Doesn't everybody know one cranky person?
Well, yeah.
So anyway, he tried, and I realized he was trying to hunt down my weakness. So when he hit it, I didn't react, so he didn't know he'd hit it, and he went on trying other things.
Well, you can...
So I pulled it off.
You can tell us now what that... We won't... It's... statute of limitations has passed. You can tell
oh,
us.
Oh, I don't even remember. I don't like to remember. I don't think about trying to remember my weaknesses.
Well, no. Okay. So, and that was, I mean, you were working with Kattiger, you were working with guys like Bob Haney, you were working with Kubert. I mean, this is, again, this is all freelance, though, right? You weren't spending a whole lot of time in the national offices, I wouldn't think.
No.
Yeah.
No. He used to take pride in the fact that when we were all going to lunch, that he'd sit down and write a script, and it'll be ready when you get back from lunch. And he also developed these little bits and pieces that he'd stick in a lot of stories. One of his favorites was the haystacks that hid AK-AK guns, and then he'd have Stukas come down and that... Another one was throwing a grenade down the barrel of a tank.
Yeah.
And I, for a couple more.
Yeah.
And of course, a grenade wouldn't touch the kind of steel that's in the barrel of a,
yeah,
a gun. And so I would take his script, and I was always looking for space to draw something that people would like to look at, you know. And I learned through size is important. If you take a ravenous dog and he's this big, it doesn't bother you much. But if you open it up and it's a whole page, whoa! You know, so size is important to try to go for, you know, where you need it for the drama. And so of course, when he'd have that stuff that didn't particularly advance the story,
yeah.
I'd just cross it out and go, not and drop it out and move to the next page to get more space.
I can't imagine that went well.
Well, he apparently never checked.
Excellent. Good. Okay.
Because nothing was ever said. Yeah. And that wouldn't be like him not to say anything.
That's very true.
His ego, you know.
Yes.
Boy, what an egotistical man.
Were there any writers or other artists that you felt simpatico with? Or were there writers whose work you look forward to? Or were there...
Yeah, Hank Chapman was one of the writers I thought was we worked well together.
Yeah.
I mean, with storyline and so on. Stan turned out tons of, I did tons of Stan stories. You know, Stan never won an award for writing.
No, I know.
And it's. What's the next question?
Well, then how about other artists? Did you have like a drink?
Oh, like Ross Andrew.
Yeah.
We became friends,
yeah.
And his wife sometimes delivered the work when he didn't want to come in.
Yeah.
So we got into a thing where my latest girlfriend and the two of them,
yeah.
And the four of us would go out to Northern Chinese and have... what do you call them? Spring
rolls and stuff. Yeah.
Well, that's not what I'm thinking of. But anyway,
so Andrew, and then who else was in your drinking buddy?
Oh, pack? Gray Morrow.
Oh, Gray Morrow was great.
He was a superb person.
Yeah,
I loved him dearly. He had a horse. Out in Jersey, and I went out and rode the horse one time, and he had pistols. He had worked up a range in the basement, so we went one afternoon. We spent, shooting up the basement, and in general, he was just a great guy. We went swimming together and stuff.
Cool.
And in fact, he's how I originally got to California. He says, you've never been to California. And he says, I think you kind of like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The California lifestyle compared to the East. So he said, we're going out and we're going to stay with Ralph Bakshi because he's a friend of mine. And so we did, but Bakshi's mother came on a surprise visit and here went our place to stay. So we ended up at midnight in a motel for one night, figuring when we hit the studios, the animation studios, that we'd find other friends and be able to stay with them.
Yeah.
But we kept ending up at the end of the night trying to find a place that had a room still left over. And it was really very strange. We were very different in some ways from each other. For instance, when I go to sleep, I have a T-shirt and briefs, and that's my pajamas. He, on the other hand, had pajamas and maybe a dressing gown, and a cigarette in a holder, and he put something in his coffee out of a little bottle, you know, so on. And so he had this. Rigmarole at time to go to sleep, you know. And I burst out of the bathroom the first night and made a flying dive over the end of the bed, figuring that when the dive is over, you've got to be in a limp, comfortable position. And so all of a sudden he looks up, you know, and I come zooming into the room and dive under the bed. And there's dead silence for like a whole minute. And he says, you know, Russ, we never talk anymore. I think I've heard that before somewhere. That struck me so funny. I fell out of bed onto the floor.
Did you stay in California after that?
he came, of course, came back, but I got a job offer, and I said, I'll go back home, put my stuff in storage, because I knew I wouldn't know where to live.
Right.
Because in California, you can move, you know, 8 blocks, and you're in a whole different
neighborhood. Yeah,
attitude. Exactly. So my stuff stayed in storage about 30 years. Luckily, it was temperature controlled. My leather couch came through fine.
What jobs did you find out in California? I mean, what?
Well, I was working in, at that time, comics was a kind of downhill.
Yeah.
So I was working in animation.
And this is roughly.
Oh, dude, you did storyboards, you did model sheets, layouts, what they called layouts in those days, which shows the scene, and you learn about how it works.
Right.
And putting stuff on a loop that goes around, like if you're drawing a fence, you know, the fence will come around again, but you won't know, the audience won't know that.
Right, yeah.
But you're using the same fence. And I was known already as a pretty good artist, so I thought I would help some of the ones that were having problems, which wasn't a good idea. because this one girl was, she had the moon on a loop. And I said, "Do you ever drive down the beach?" I said, "The moon doesn't keep going by." It shouldn't be on the loop. It should be, you know.
Well, roughly what period of time are we talking about here? This is...
Oh, early 70s.
Early 70s, okay. And then, and then before that or after that, that little Annie Fanny came into the picture?
It was after.
Yeah.
No, wait.
Or was it, I think?
No, it wasn't.
Before. I thought a little before. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so,
it was before.
Yeah.
Because I was working in New York, I had my mother died, and I moved back with my father to make sure he could handle it. And then I was working on the dining room table, and the door opened, and he came in, and it was 12:30, and I said, "He's been out on a date, and so I can't really be keeping him company here. So it's now time I can." And of course, if you're single. And living that close to New York, the place to be was in New York.
Yeah.
So I got an apartment in New York and moved there. And so I was started working on Annie Fanny for Harvey.
Right. How did that happen? How did that, I mean, you'd known Harvey, obviously.
Well, Harvey used me on everything that he did.
Right.
Help and Humbug and Trump and you name it.
Right.
Everything but Esquire, I guess. But that was before my time. And so one of the things we flew back and forth with the pages because we were working on the third floor of the Playboy Mansion to get the first couple of issues off the ground.
That must have been terrible.
Oh, just awful.
Yeah.
Well, there's stories there, but that's another thing.
We have an audience. There's like people right here. They want to hear. One story. Just give one story.
Okay, it was known that there were, I don't know, half a dozen bunnies currently in the mansion. He gave some of them like apartments so that they could, at cost, so that they could come from Illinois or wherever they were from and save their money up and you know.
Yeah.
So, and we're saying, where are these? We haven't seen the hide nor hair of a girl since we got here.
Yeah.
Of course, we were supposed to go from where we were working to the lunch counter, down to the dining room, and et cetera. And we didn't see anything. And he says, "Where are the girls?" "Oh, they finished lunch. They left before you, or they haven't gotten here yet." You know, and it goes on for like 10 days. So one night I decided, Willie Elder had what he called his paint pants. Most guys have a rag that they wipe their brush on, and he wiped it on his pants. This one pair of special paint pants. And what's the guy that did the fold-out in the middle of the book?
Al Jaffe?
Al Jaffe?
Yes.
Yeah.
Al Jaffe. I had never met him before, but he was working on Annie, and we became a great friend. And the three of us, Willie Elder was sitting up there, and then Al, and then me. So we'd be sitting there for an hour and a half or something, and I said, Al, what is that odor? You know, and he, it must be Willie's pants. You know, so we did this unmerciful, you know, thing on his pants. So one night I decided to do more.
Yeah.
So he folded his pants up in the square and put it by his bed before he went to sleep.
Okay.
So after he was asleep, I got his pants, and I took a razor blade, and I opened up every third stitch.
Yeah.
In fact, I did it so much that I didn't think they would hold together well enough to fold up and put back there.
Yeah.
And I cut the cuffs off the pants at the bottom. I cut all the pockets out. The pants had been taken in 4 inches. I cut that out. So the pants were now 4 inches bigger than when he took them off the night before. So in the morning, everybody's kind of lingering around to see, will he discover that? What happened? And Willie puts on his pants, and we're lingering around the bathroom door, and he's looking in the mirror about shaving, you know. And he's standing there, and he pulled all the spare material to the back. And about the time he finished that, he pulled it all around, totally out of it, to the front. And we're going crazy, you know, not to laugh. And he didn't get it, you know. And so finally we had to go down for lunch and or breakfast, whatever it was. And I thought, we can't get downstairs, you know. The joke is no fruition yet.
Yeah.
So as we're walking down the stairs, I grabbed a hold and yanked, and the pants came apart from the back bottom of the fly to his belt in the back. And we thought it'd be a giveaway, you know. And
yeah.
He just grabbed one and held it over the other, and he says, "Look, you ruined my good paint pants." You know? But he didn't realize, you know, it was a deliberate thing. And so, but I had secretly got his size and bought him another pair of brand new ones, hidden under the lunch table, and to bring out at the crucial moment. So suddenly, and still the joke wasn't going on. So I leaned over and I took his pockets, which I had in my hand, you know. And I said, "Look, pieces are falling off these pants." And he said, and now it clicks in that somebody's been tampering. And he says, "You ruined my good pants."
You know?
And then I brought out the other pants. And he went the opposite way, from like almost being ready to hit me to almost giving me a hug and a kiss. He was so overcome that somebody would buy him something. But unfortunately, I had the wrong size, and they didn't. So he went into the John, and we're sitting at the table waiting for him to come out in his new pants. And he door opens, and he comes sailing out with them all, whipping in the wind behind him. But it all worked out in the end.
Yeah. Now, how long were you on the fanny pack?
The main point is, just when I tore it, the pants open at the back, four girls were come around the landing, they come up. You had to take your pants down to see the girls. It struck us funny at the time.
Now, how long did you work with Harvey on the fanny stuff?
Well, eventually, I was getting paranoid about New York. At the time, it was a really pretty unsafe place. I figured I couldn't carry enough ammo to go on the subway.
Yeah.
So I was really paranoid about living in New York. And Hefner knew that I liked Chicago. Mm-hmm. Chicago's friendly. A girl walking down the street says hi, you know. Hmm. So anyway, he knew that, and so I kept telling Harvey I need more money. And Harvey says, "You're working for Playboy magazine," and I said, "I can't feed my kids that, you know." And so finally, I got fed up, and one morning he came down from his house upstate to pick up the work, and we'd cut it all apart, and we had tissues and with stickum on it, and stickum sticking at the stickum. It was a mess, but we cut the whole page in half, so he'd have something to work on, and I'd have something to work on. So I was up all night doing this thing with all these overlays, and he doesn't tell me when he's coming down that he's bringing all his kids with him. So when I answered the door in my briefs and t-shirt, they all come running in, you know. I said, So later, I'm sitting there after they all run out, and I think one of them took my spyglass apart and flushed the lenses down the toilet, which didn't go over either. So I'm sitting there, and I said, "This isn't working." So I waited till he got home, and I called him up, and I says, "Come on down and pick it up because I'm finished. I'm done." Well, he panicked, and by 5 o'clock, Hefner's on the phone. Hmm. And I explained my problem to him, and he says, "I know you like Chicago." He says, "I will move you. I'll pay to move you to Chicago. I will give you my old office to work out of," which had full ice box, all TV, everything. "I'll double your salary." It was too good, not to take advantage of. So that's how I got to Chicago, living in Chicago.
Yeah.
And wasn't that the question, how I got to Chicago?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Right. So I want to open this up to questions in a minute, but there's one other person that you work with who I would love to hear you talk a little bit about if you can, and that was Archie Goodwin.
Oh, he was just the greatest. He wrote some very nice things about me in some editorials and so on. I said in that thing about Easy's First Tiger, which was a big drawing that became quite famous because I put so much into it, turned out that everybody loved it. And they said, in his article, he says, "And all the people, the next package comes in, will all be running to see what that son of a bitch has done now."
Yeah.
And he said, "And whatever it is," and they said, "he could probably do Mickey Mouse if need be." And I thought that was one of the nicest things that I had ever heard.
I thought you guys were a really good team.
And he was a great writer. I'll tell you how great. A lot of writers don't have much visualization powers. In other words, to see the scene in front of them when they're writing the story. Well, he did this one story, and he had an extra bunch of sheets, and he had it all in stick figures as he visioned the pictures. And I thought, I don't want to look at this because I'll be influenced.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is I'll do my own stick figure version, and then I'll go back, and the ones where I think he got it better, I'll use his. Where I got it better, I'll use mine. Out of 40 of them, there was only one that was different.
Wow.
They were all...
Man.
He and I saw... He had enough visualization to see it the same way I did.
It's amazing.
And, that just knocked me out.
Yeah.
But he had that... He did... I did several of his stories, and... Wheezy... Walt Simonson's wife was one of my editors there, and she used to give me 3 scripts and see which one appealed to me and take the other 2 back. And so I got to do some stories that were better than I would have gotten just taking what came next.
Yeah.
and I had a lot of fun with it. It was nobody going to color it and ruin, you know, the painting.
Right.
You could paint it as painterly as you wanted it in tones of gray. So I went for it,
yeah.
You know, and did some of my, I think, my best stuff. And a lot of people agree with me. And but Archie was top notch. He late worked for him later on too when I was doing some The Dark Knight or
right, yeah.
So on, and it had a lot of stuff where this guy with razor tip fingers, like what's his name?
I know what we're talking
all
about.
Right.
Yeah.
And then breaking into the college dorms with these girls in their mini 90s and so on, and you know, but that's what the script asked for, so that's what I gave.
Yeah.
And they were sitting on a desk. I heard this later, and the writer Doug Munch and he were looking, and he says, "I don't know. What do you think?" And he says, "Well, that's what we asked for." So they printed it, but it was pretty gruesome.
Yeah.
I had a lady cop in Central Park, and the slasher comes by, and her fingers go flying, and you know, which wasn't, you know, it was far too much.
Yeah, but that's what they asked for.
Unnecessary.
That's what they asked for. That's what they.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you get so close, you don't realize how much they're asking.
Yeah.
You know, you lose. Because each thing can be a little inch worse.
Right.
And so you're doing terrible stuff.
Yeah.
So it's human nature.
Well, I'd like to, if I can, open this up real quickly to some questions. Ed?
Russ, everyone in this room thinks you're a fantastic artist across many different genres. War, superhero like Dark Knight.
Romance stuff, the horror stuff. Yeah.
What do you enjoy doing best, and what genre do you think showcased your talents the most?
Can you? Sure. I can't hear
well. That's fine. What of all the genres that you've worked in all the years, which ones have you enjoyed the most, and which ones do you think have shown your talent the best?
Well, I think the Warrens go a long way to show my talent at its best.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed most of those more than the other stuff because some of the big Marvel and DC. The editors took the stuff home for their kids to color over the weekend.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah, but the Warren production values were really, I mean, the magazines looked really good. Like you said, there was all black and white with tones, so you had control over what the final product would look like. So,
yeah.
Who else?
Oh, and he said, I thought he said superheroes. I never bought costume things, you know, because I'm too much of a realist. And so when I draw somebody in a masquerade suit, that's what he looks like, a man standing there in a suit.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, it's not true to the character that has originated 20 years before, you know, like the Shadow.
Right.
Or
I mean, do you consider yourself more of an illustrator or more of a cartoonist?
I started out to be an illustrator.
Yeah.
Well, my first, I used to go to all the illustrators looking for work.
Right.
And, but it's, then photography took over.
Yeah.
And, you know, Saturday Evening Post didn't need covers anymore because they went out of business. Collier's went out of business. Liberty Magazine. So the market dried up for illustrators. And of course, I worked in some of the ad agencies doing storyboards. And I was one of the first people, two of the agencies, that every storyboard I drew was produced.
No.
And I'm not claiming that it was entirely my fault, because if the copywriter didn't give me something to work with, you can't run with nothing. So it was not totally my doing, but anyway.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Who are your favorite illustrators in the current generation we're working now?
Are there any illustrators in the current generation who catch your eye?
I don't know where they'd be working. I don't think there's any regular market.
Yeah.
So.
Or just cartoonist or anything like that. Anybody whose work you still look at. Anybody whose work, any of the newer kids who seem to have some potential.
Oh well, yeah. There's what's the one? AH.
Oh, Adam Hughes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
He's way ahead of where I was at his age. He can draw like a son of a...
No kidding, that guy.
And there's a bunch of guys like that.
Yeah.
And you'll know, you know, you don't need my help to know who they are.
By the way, you just made Adam Hughes' day. And says, go tell him now. It will be over the moon. Mr. Suntra, sir.
What about your work for National Lampoon?
Ah, what about your work for National Lampoon? What was that like?
Oh, I'm not terribly sure the instigating factor, but I know I went over and Michael Gross was the editor and he gave me some stuff to do, which he liked very much, and gave me more stuff to do. So I did stuff regularly for National Lampoon, and that was more adult.
Yeah, say, yeah.
And,
says the man who did Little Annie Fanny.
So on and so on.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's a really memorable story that you inked. It was a Michael Golden story, a Mr. Miracle story that came out in the 70s. Yeah. What's your experience, Russ, inking other artists, and did you get pleasure out of it?
That's a good question. There have been a few times in your career where you've been doing the inking over somebody else's pencils. He mentioned Michael Golden, who did a job in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a rewarding thing for you? Is that a different set
well,
of muscles?
Well, it was just what they gave me that week to do.
Yeah.
So I did it. I didn't particularly... He and I don't work that closely.
Yeah.
Our styles aren't that close, but... It was rewarding to me because afterward he said that he learned some things from what I did with his stuff that helped, and I don't know what it was.
Well, I can say that for whatever it's worth, if I helped him,
because he's certainly one of my favorites.
Yeah, and so for whatever it's worth, there, even though it was only one job, those of us who know of the job would still remember it fondly after all this year. So clearly there was something there. We've got time for one more. Yes, sir.
How was it working with the late Dave Stevens?
What was it like working with the late Dave Stevens?
Oh, marvelous. We met where they did Godzilla. The heck is the name of the studio?
University.
No longer in existence. Hanna-Barbera.
Aye.
And he was there, and we became, I don't know why, because we had quite an age difference, but we became great buddies. We caused a lot of havoc in that place, running up and down the hall like school kids, and hollering, and disrupting the flow of everything. I remember once we decided to get some rays of sun during lunch hour, so we climbed up the ladder to the roof and, of course, took off our shirts, and then we figured we'd better take our trousers off to get more sun on our legs. And we're sitting there, and I said, you know, Dave, if anybody sees us up here, we've had it. So anyway, but he was... And a great artist. I mean, you know, I loved it. I worked a little bit on some of his things on the side, and just little corners of pictures. And, of course, then when he did the Rocketeer movie, there wasn't time for him to make a book to be published simultaneously with the release of the movie. So I was called in, and... An old friend of mine was the editor, and I can't remember at the moment his name, but, he's the one that did Moose, Myron Moose or something.
Foster, right?
Foster was the editor on it, and I had lived at his house for a while when I first came out, and Dave, so can't say too much about Dave. As they said, we were always cutting up and doing cartoons of other people in the business, which couldn't be shown.
Well, I'm very grateful for all the work that you have done over the years that can be shown. You are, in my eyes, still as good as you ever were, if not better. I see even the most recent stuff that you do on the side here and there. It's been our privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much for giving us this time. And ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to hear another big hand.